This week on the Talking Footy podcast, we caught up with Premiership player and coach, the AFL trailblazer, Mick Malthouse. 174 games a player for St Kilda and Richmond, 718 games as head coach of Footscray, West Coast, Collingwood, Carlton, and father of four, grandfather of eight. Mick opened up on the highs and lows of his career and amazing life lessons learnt along the way, from measures of success to being your authentic self. Michael Malthouse, thank you very much for joining us here on the Talking Footy podcast. There's so much to go over in such a very short time that we've got with you here. But to start with, obviously career coach, career in the football, now very much a family man, eight grandchildren,
not finished, I don't think. Not that I've got any say in that.
What is more challenging, dealing with the Rat Pack back in the day or juggling the grandchildren turbocharged on red cordial?
Well, the Rat Pack looked after themselves. The eight grandchildren are interesting because they're just all such individuals and they're all so close. Even though the families aren't necessarily living totally near each other, anytime we get together, they inspire me because their closeness is so, it's so apparent. They don't need to be told they're cousins. They just automatically seem to know it. But they're all so different. You know, we try to go and see Zach, our oldest, play footy on the weekend, and then we try to see Holly, who plays basketball the next day, and she's eight. And then we try to go to the ballet, which Lily does when she's seven. Tommy hasn't really worked out what he wants to do yet. Then it gets down to the next four. We say the next four because there's just a little gap in years, and they no doubt will drag us along to their sports or arts or whatever else they do.
I mean, obviously being a player and then a career coach, the demands are so high. And I can see you now, you're beaming talking about your grandchildren. How difficult was it during the early years with your own children, juggling all of it and the priorities?
Yeah, it's interesting because what you don't know, you don't know the future. And as a player, I was an okay player. I had a lot of injuries, which probably precluded me from getting, you know, I played 170 odd games. I disappointingly, got injuries at the wrong time. One year I played every game, missed the grand final, dislocated my shoulder. You know, so you look at that and you think, you know, it was good at some stages, but it tested you in other times. So that testing, you know, we were married early, Nan and myself, 21, and our first child came along at 23. And now we're almost better, you know, best friends. So there was challenges because I didn't know, you know, football in those days was all Saturday afternoon. So you train Monday, Tuesday, sometimes Wednesday, Thursday. And you work during the week. So you're able to engage with your family pretty much. They'd come to the game, or they'd come to the after match, or they'd come to the Sunday training. When you're coaching, I had no idea I was going to coach. I wanted to coach. Mm. At what level? My level, I never dreamt that I'd ever be a VFL coach. I applied for the Wangaratta Rovers. I then applied for Central Districts, and I missed that. So I was almost going to go and play again until I got a call from Footscray, which is totally out of the blue. But then you didn't. I was actually working and coaching, so I had no time for the family. So Nanette was so good, but somehow we managed. Somehow the kids, Nanette was one of these people that engaged. So if she came to the game, the kids come to the game, and they would stay in the creche, and we'd meet up after the game, and then we'd go out after the game, and then Sunday, you know, I'd take the kids to the Channel 7 or the Channel 10 show that used to be on the Sundays. And as they got older, I became full-time, and then I was able to go to their sporting events as often as I could. in the West, because of the travelling requirements, the regret was that you didn't do as near as often as you would have liked.
Yeah.
But I quite often feel bad about it till you talk to the kids and say, well, and they say, no, we didn't miss out.
They understood.
They understood, but they say they know they didn't miss out. So it makes you feel better when you know that they, if they had said, oh, Dad, you weren't at this, you weren't at that, you feel, oh my God, has it been worth it? It has been worth it. It's had its price,
yeah.
But they're all well balanced. We're still very much a close family. And then come back then coach again. Well, they were then engaging in that even further because they'd come to the games and they'd come in after the game and we'd go out during the week and that sort of stuff.
And as a coach, did that mean that you had a greater sense of leniency for your players that had their own families?
Absolutely. Took it totally into consideration as best you can.
Yeah.
Because if they haven't got that as a priority, then they've got a mucked up life. Their football must be second, high second, to family. And we just, it's like waking up in the morning, you don't say, now let's switch on, we need to breathe to walk around. No, you just say, okay, there's the family, now my football, because if one is influencing the other, both will break down.
Yeah.
So it's so important that as best you can manage it, give the opportunity. Even my coaches, I introduced way back when I was in the West, we had to have one day off. And I said, one day off's a little bit of a misnomer in terms of I'm not working. You are working, but you work on times that suit you. Take the kids to school. Go and have lunch with your wife. Pick your kids up from school. Now, that doesn't stop you doing some work at home or when they go to bed at night. Come to the training on the Friday, if it was a Saturday match. You're fresher. Come prepared. But what it did, it meant that they were able to engage with their families.
And you've seen the entire evolution of the game, been involved in it for that long, and of course most recently at Carlton. Is the balance skew if? Are the demands on the players and then by extension the coaches, the industry demands too great and creating this imbalance?
I think the balance can be out of whack. I think that you can make... I don't know how much time we've got here, but I look at the... I've gone to America and I've gone to England and I've studied the coaches more than the game, as in American Gridiron and EPL. And I love both guys, particularly EPL. But I asked one coach one day, I said, what hours do you work? And he said, was an assistant coach and they were working later and later and they would bend down on a Tuesday night. He's still there all night. And I said, what are you looking for? And they said, we'll find, if we go through it long enough, we'll find this passage, this play that we need to work on or defend or whatever the case is. I said, have you ever thought of that you may be looking for a needle in the haystack and will still be there next morning because you're tired instead of being fresh and then have a, it's a bit like doing a crossword. You can't find the word, you wake up next morning, there it is. And his answer was, oh, well, if we don't do that, we're against the norm because everyone else is doing it. But I don't know whether everyone else is right. So have we got the balance right? Players seem to have more time. Maybe the Players Association have been right in making sure players have got a bit more time. Coaches, you've got to have a good balance to get a good result. That's my opinion. What is a good balance? That's going to be determined on probably club by club. It depends where you are.
Yeah.
I coached 10 years in the West and that was very, very difficult because you're travelling a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think people really appreciate a travelling team, the requirements.
Well, we'll come back to some more of those philosophies and your thoughts in a second, but just to get nostalgic for a minute, obviously playing career with St Kilda and Richmond, a premiership player at Richmond. Do you have a connection with the Tigers? Was there a sense of pride when you saw them winning last year? What's the feeling you get when you reflect on a premiership as a player?
Yeah, I've still got a real soft spot for the Saints because I spent my first 4 years there in an environment that I didn't think I belonged because as much as I wanted to play VFL football, I arrived at the Saints when they were off the back of a grand final against Hawthorn in 71. So they're a really good football side, and I kept on asking myself, why am I here? So, and I was there for 4.5 years with the great and late Alan Jones. Then to go to Richmond and to have 3 or 4 coaches, all either premiership coaches or premiership players, and really good people. And you bleed, if you bleed at a football club and you have some form of success, I reckon it's sort of my grandson's grandma jumper, premiership jumper. It's on his wall. He buries the Tykes. That probably tells you
really
where you feel.
Yeah.
You know, because you've done the hard yards. You know, you've had some good times, you've had some bad times. And players, unless you're a superstar, you're inevitably going to have a lot of times thinking about a bad game or a bad injury or something like that.
Am I right in saying that once you'd finished playing at Richmond, they offered you, or they sort of offered and then took back the coaching position and then reserve coaching?
Yeah, it was a really weird situation. I actually hadn't thought about that until, because once I got the Footscray job, everything sort of just, you know, my mind just went forward,
yeah.
not backwards. But yeah, I was offered the, called in and, Dixon, I can't think of his first name. The CEO, the then general manager said, "Oh, look, we're thinking of making you a senior coach." And I thought, "Well, wow, where's this come from?" Because I was keen, but all of a sudden I had this job, and don't say anything, don't say, "Oh, no, I wouldn't say anything." Anyway, a couple of days later, "Oh, look, we've rethought it. You know, it didn't really work out with Francis, and you're a player coming into coaching. We just don't want to have public opinion thing the same." I'm totally different to Francis,
but yeah.
But and I accepted that because it was sort of coming out of the blue. "But would you be seconds coach?" I said, "Yeah, I'd love to," because I had, yeah. Anyway, a couple of days later, they said, "Oh, look, we can't give you that because you're probably a bit too ambitious for us." And I thought, I'm going to be very careful here. But when you say that, I said, "I hope you're not thinking that I'd ever." No, you know, you're not a stabbing type.
Yeah, and
stuff.
Yeah.
I said, "Well, be careful."
I mean, that's almost a blessing in disguise, knowing how Richmond sort of transpired thereafter in terms of their coaches.
Yeah.
It could have been very, very different.
Well, it was interesting because when they put Michael Patterson on, and I got put on in January, a very late call-up for Footscray, because Bluey Hampshire had it until then. He resigned or was sacked, I don't know what, which. And my first game was against the Tykes. So it was really, really is.
Ironic.
And coaching against really good friends, Robbie Wiley and Mervyn Kane and all those sort of blokes, and it was weird, but you move on very quickly.
Of course, that was a sliding doors moment of sorts, 6 years as coach at Footscray, and then over to the West. I was a West Coast fan growing up,
yeah.
So those players in that era that you were at the helm, the Wild West?
Now, this is an interesting story. I always took exception to people saying it was a stateside, because when I arrived there, we were 11th of 14. So we're 11th position of 14. And as a interest, given I don't really watch football shows, but Glenn Jacobs was on last night, and I thought, listen to this. I thought, I'm going to go through the team that won in 92 and see how many players that were already there and how many players I actually recruited. So when I got there, you know, so when I looked at that side, I think there was not, and I only had 20 in those days, we didn't have 22, I think there was 9 players that I drafted. So every one of those players could have been drafted by anyone else.
Yeah.
So there's nearly half the side were drafters. So and I'm gonna say this, that of all those players, basically most of them, I suppose, were Western Australian people. Now, but no one was stopping Victorian clubs from drafting Western Australians. In fact, they used to draft them like you couldn't believe. Yeah. So that's one of the things. It's a misnomer, really, that side was stacked tight. It turned out to be a very good football side, because in 91, I say unfortunately, I was given the role of state coach, state of origin coach. Well, my state of origin is Victoria, but they gave me that job. Yeah. And we won by a record amount against Victoria, and we had a lot of West Coast players in it. So it was sort of deemed that, but most of those were draftees.
Mm. Some of those players I think very back good. Of, Kemp, Mainwaring, Kenner, Waterman, Lewis, Jakovic.
Yeah. And you know, the great thing about it is they were really good people, really, really decent citizens. I've enjoyed all my coaching and I've enjoyed all my players, and I'm not going to say but the West Coast because that isolates it, but those, so many of those blokes, just little Tony Evans and Peter Simic, there's Troy Ugle, who did play in the Premiership, Craig Turley, who played in one, Mitchell White played in one. They're just great people. I love talking to them when I get the chance. I never chase them down.
Yeah.
But if I bump into them, I love talking to them.
You sort of mentioned...
Donny Pike.
Sorry?
There's another one, Donny Pike.
Yeah.
Good mention.
Yeah. I mean, you touched on before Glenn Jakovic, and you went back over the team that you're a part of and that you recruited. You keep all of your football records? I mean, you've got every year you've sort of kept material from each?
No.
No.
Wish I had
it. You get rid of it? Or what? I mean, I know some coaches, they meticulously sort of keep everything.
I wish I had. You know, it's funny because when I got the Footscray job, it came so far out of the blue. It never dawned on me to record, to take, to keep, to do anything. I've got very little of anything left of coaching materials.
Mm. Not necessarily a nostalgic person.
I believe greatly in history and nostalgia, but I've got photographs and a few things like that, but they're all under, sort of like with my kids or whatever. Yeah. I said about my jumper, on the wall with young Zach. I think there's the footballs, the sort of the milestone footballs are scattered with all the kids. They've gone out. I'm not materialistic like that. I do believe strongly in history, but I guess... If you knew that you were going to coach the length, you'd probably start to put things aside.
Yeah.
But I had no idea. I think the longest contract I signed was probably 2 years. Yeah. I'll stand corrected. It may well have been three initially, perhaps, and I say perhaps. It certainly wasn't three at West Coast. It was two, I think. May have been three at Collingwood first up, but then it just went 1 year or 2 years best. So I never felt secure ever in my coaching.
Was that by design? You didn't ask for a long-term contract or the clubs didn't offer you?
Didn't offer, and also I'm a pretty insecure person. So I'm one of those people that if it's in your hand and you can wrap your fingers around, it's yours. Mm-hmm. If it's promised to you and going to be there, and if it's not there, it's not yours. So those things are future. So if you said, you coach the Dogs for 6 years, I'd go, well, really? Well, how fantastic. Or coach West Coast for 10 years. We went across there for 2 years.
Yeah.
Save for 10.
Played finals every year.
But you don't know those things. So on reflection, I would have loved to have kept certain items, but it didn't happen.
Yeah. What do you have certain pieces of memorabilia that mean more to you, that you've held on to, or you specifically...
No, I've got a medallion worn by my grandfather that he won in Gordon Football Club.
In Central Highlands?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I don't think it was Central Highlands in those days. This is 1914, 1914, 1516. Then I think my father had some cups, which unfortunately disappeared or got thrown out after he died. So, No, I don't. I've kept the Jock Cone medals and I've got the grand final medals, but I'll give those off to my kids as soon as I want them, they can have them.
Of course, 10 years at West Coast and then to Collingwood, and you experienced a certain level of success really early in your tenure there, whilst not achieving the
ultimate. I reckon I did achieve the ultimate in 2002.
Yeah.
If we measure football life on premierships, I think there's going to be a lot of disappointed people. Bobby Skilton's one of the greatest players in history, never played a premiership. Robbie Flower, The list goes on and goes on. But 1987 and 2002 and perhaps 1992 were probably as good a years as you'd get. 2002 with the side to get to that grand final and play off against the almighty Fitzroy Brisbane,
yep,
with seven or eight All-Australians, three Brownlow medalists and God knows what else, with the side we had, that's game. If I look back on my career then, that is a highlight year.
So let's unpack that a little bit. As a player and as a coach, the purpose we're sort of told is, yes, to win a premiership, right?
Of course.
But you're suggesting that some of your most enjoyable years and that level of success isn't necessarily determined by, and nor should it be. I'm sort of playing devil's advocate a little bit here.
Well, it
should be determined by premierships won.
Well, there's only one premiership per year.
Yeah.
So that meant that the other sides and everything has failed. 1987, I didn't make the finals. I was in a side that did not make the finals in 1987. One of my best years. So, without a doubt, because it's not the trophy at the end. I don't want to be measured on trophies. I want to be measured on effort. And the effort in 1987, when you get beaten by 42 goals in your first three games, because your side's dissipated, the club were broke. We had captain go up to Sydney, we had best and fairest go up to Brisbane, we had retirees, and I had under 19 kids come through, the reserves are no good, so under 19 kids come through. We lost the first three games by 42 goals, playing round four, the reigning premiers in Hawthorn. Missed out in the finals by 2 points, so at half a game. Beat Hawthorn in that game. And I got more joy by the end of 87 knowing that we could not have wrung any more out of that group. And yet, you know, probably over half the side wouldn't get a game with anyone else.
In reflection, I'd imagine that's easier to say. During those pre-season periods of those seasons, the goal or the aim,
yeah,
would you suggest that it is to, you know, for your teams to play finals, to finish top four,
yep,
to win a premiership,
yep,
or is your part of your magic sauce effort based?
Well,
only,
no, it's more than that, because it's certainly effort based, but it's also, you've got to be an optimist and you've got to say, righto, we are capable of, realistically, you've got to have a realism about you and say, we're going to make the four. In those days, it was the four. We are going to make the four. We've got to try to make the four. And in the back of your mind, you know that in that year, you know, Carlton and Hawthorn and someone else was just superior. So if you can sneak in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the goal. But after game one and game two and game three, you reassess where you're at when you've lost by 42 goals. Indeed.
Yep.
It's then based on the next contest more than even the next game. And that's what we focused on. You've got to remember, I'm only a very young, I was 30 when I started coaching. So every game taught me a lesson,
mm-hmm,
and taught some of my players lessons. I tagged with Tony McGuinness on the great John Platt, and he knocked him over comprehensively. But he didn't think he had it in him to be a tagging player. But he had to, because we were just going to get slaughtered all year. And it changed the dynamics of our team. And in many respects, it gave Tony McGuinness a new look at football.
So what would be this experienced mentor that you are now? What would be the three lessons that you'd tell to a younger self, to a younger Mick Malthouse just starting out as a coach?
Okay. Well, the first one was, and simply is, I got a message from a great mentor come coach of mine. Be Mick Malthouse, don't be anyone else. So that's the first thing. Or whoever it is in front of you, be yourself.
What if we don't like Mick Malthouse?
No, but be yourself. Don't be yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what you've got to be, is be yourself totally. But at least acknowledge history. History is the greatest lesson giver of all time. So you can defy history, but history will catch up with you. So have a look at why and how you're formed. And so, right, I'm still going to be myself, but I've got to acknowledge that the game is such, I owe the game this.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what sort of people do I want playing for me? So, therefore, one of the greatest leaders in, we hear about a lot of great leaders, but one that's in particular that's my Bible is Ernest Shackleton. And the only reason why his crew were able to survive because he chose the right people. So if I'm going to say, you said you were one of the fixers, be yourself a start. Get the best type of person around you. Don't be intimidated by how good they might be and better than you are in certain aspects. And finally is formulate something that is going to be practical for your group and run with it, but don't be scared to change it.
Yeah. You mentioned the advice your mentor gave you. Can I ask who that
was? That was Alan Jeans.
That was Alan Jeans?
Yeah.
Did you have a mentor throughout the entirety of your coaching career? Do you still have one now?
No. I use that word loosely, mentor. I shouldn't use it because I really didn't have anyone that I was dependent on. Growing up, I suppose, you get your parents and my grandfather came into it and my father got ill. But basically, I learned from people, but I never had anyone that I didn't want anyone. When I look back now, it was more a choice. I didn't want any one person to be, I didn't want to be dependent on any one person.
Yeah.
So when Jeans rang me up and said, congratulations, but be Mick Malthus, I said, well, I'm not going to be anyone else. But it was good hearing it because it was just reinforced that I wanted to be who I was, not anyone else. And so I could throw Tommy Hafey in there because he had a profound effect also. When you've got two contrasting coaches, the greatest thing that came out of that for me when they coached me was they're both premiership coaches. They both get the best out of their people, but they both do it so differently. So in my eyes, it was fantastic because it said there's not a particular way of getting people to the top. Because if Jeans can get it being a highly defensive coach, and Hafey can get it by being a very offensive coach, then I can sit in the middle and do what I want to do, and I can still get there. I don't have to be Jeans, I don't have to be Hafey.
Just to jumping around a little bit, a few tangents, and to jump back in the timeline, obviously finished up at Collingwood after a long period of time there, and then crossed over to the arch rival in Carlton.
Yeah.
What was part of the appeal? What did you see in that club that that attracted you?
I felt at Collingwood that I wasn't finished. You know, it was the way it was and that sort of stuff. I was out of football for 12 months, driving everyone nuts. But I didn't have my eyes on Carlton at all. It was just that I had a call from Greg Swan, who wanted me to introduce me to Stephen Kernahan. And they came to my house and they said, we would like you to coach Carlton. And then it got on very, very well with Leonie Swan. And I think Nanny was the one who didn't want me to coach.
It's always the key, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go through the wires.
And so I think Leonie might have sort of hinted that it would be a good club to come in. But the worst thing about the Carlton thing was that the two people who put me on were gone in 18 months. Greg Swan had been sacked and Stephen Kernahan said he'd step down after 18 months. And I knew Stephen from a distance, only as a player, just watched coached against him. But when I first met him, I had no doubts that this bloke is a really decent, fantastic person and a very strong bloke. And I thought, well, I've got now Greg Swan, who I really admired as a CEO at Collingwood, and Stephen Kernahan. So the asking was, would you coach? It didn't take long to say yes, because I thought I had them both covering what I wanted to do at Carlton. I'd like to think I helped rebuild Footscray. I'd like to think I helped build West Coast. And there's no doubt from 16th place Collingwood, I probably had three sides through that period of 12 years. Help rebuild. So I just looked at Carlton and thought, this is going to be a rebuild and it's going to take some time. But that time was cut short.
Yeah. Do you have any regrets? Or if you had your time again, you sort of mentioned that you felt your time at Collingwood wasn't it wasn't finished. You had some unfinished work there, and then again at Carlton.
Well, coaches can't choose. You know, you don't. Well, you can choose, but how many resign? You know, how many retire? Not many. So, the regret is that we just didn't have the time.
When you say we, in both circumstances,
and then the further regret was that probably through omission, I didn't get the true picture of where Carlton was at in terms of player personnel and their contracts and how long they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
So that left a little bit, you know, when I first got the job, I thought, you know, this is going to be a bit longer than what I anticipated because, you know, a lot of players were locked away and salary cap was really tight. But if you've still got to have, in any football club, you've got to have good, strong support. And nothing against who came in those positions, because they came in probably with a clean slate. But I didn't get, you know, I had great support from Rex Swan, I had great support from Stephen Kearney, because they put you on.
Yeah.
But when your allies disappear, as a football coach, you are in a lot of strife. That's just the way it works out.
Yeah. And it's... footy is a paradox in that sense, in that it is such a personal game. But as you just said, as a coach, you don't resign.
No, very few resign.
I mean, you just don't, right? And so then those personal relationships, and I would imagine it's hard not to take the sackings, I guess, or the walking. It's hard to take it not personally.
Well,
is it fair?
But when you're in a game. I think one thing is for certain, and I was too naive at Footscray, but from there on in, I realised that every coach has his name on a bullet, and it's going to get you at some stage. It just swings around and goes around. So it's going to get you, and you... It's always getting bitter and twisted about it, because you just know that the greatest and longest-serving coaches have... You know, Norm Smith got sacked by South Melbourne, I think it was, by Melbourne at one stage, you know, so... And he's, you know, marked as one of the greatest, if not the greatest coach. There wouldn't be too many coaches to survive. And they know, and if they do resign, they know the time's up. so it's getting in before the club.
He's jumping before.
But what you know, we preach loyalty, but we don't overly display it at times. And that's one of the things that when I talk to players, when I was talking to players about staying at the football club or whatever the case was, I never said you have to stay because, you know, we've been loyal to you. Because you, and the next player that comes in, you're probably telling him to leave or cut him. So you've got to get used to the fact that it's a business. You hate saying it this, but it's a business. You can only pick 22 players every week. The 23rd player is generally bitter and twisted because they go, why am I getting a game? I don't know a coach ever that picks a side not to win. That's always say to them, I've picked the side to win. That's the 22. It doesn't mean that if I bring you in, I don't think that you can win it, but that's the 22 that I think can win it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens with boards. And you know, we are very good, a good sporting nation. And we always preach that we're always there when there's doom and gloom and perhaps tragedy. But when we have to be honest, football clubs and people in them are not always up front with it. And that's disappointing, but it's the nature of, you know, who's the bearer of the bad news.
Yeah.
And some people do it up front and other people don't. And some people want you to go in a certain direction. You know, I thought at Carlton there was a direction that we needed to take. The board thought it was, and the administration thought it was another way. I'm not saying I'm right, I'm not saying they're right. But at the end of it, you accept their decision, they're going to sack you, they sack you, you move on. The only thing they haven't got is any of my grandchildren married for Carlton.
That says enough in itself.
That's right.
What did you enjoy most about coaching?
Oh, the camaraderie with the player. You know, just telling a young bloke he's got a first game, big events, you know, getting blokes over the line. And I'm really guilty of not, as a junior coach. That was if I had my time over again, I would have got a few more blokes over games that would have been monumental to them, which I didn't. Later on, I did, but as a young coach, you're so naive to it. You know, this, who cares? And this, you know, it doesn't matter. It's a sort of picky blah blah blah. So, like a bloke like Murray Rance, I think he played 98 games. You know, why couldn't I get him the extra two? And you know, I got Mayne Waring his 200th, and he says that's his late Chris. He said that was his greatest achievement, more so than the premierships. So, he had two knees that fed in. He needed walking sticks to get down the race, and I still got him over the line for his 200th. Why couldn't I have done that earlier? Because you're naive and you knew. But coaching is all, it just absorbs you, you share the wins, you share the losses, you share everything, and you see young men grow into adults.
Conversely, the camaraderie and that growth is what you enjoyed most. What did you dislike? What was the one aspect that?
I just think lack of strength at times by people instead of being right up front with you.
So dishonesty?
I wouldn't even call it dishonesty because that's a little bit too far. I'd say it's more just facing up to, one of the things that you'll always get in a football club is you know when you've won and when you've lost, because there will be certain people in the corner talking and they'll turn their back on you as you walk in the room after a game. You know full well they're talking about the result and how you're coaching. I used to say, be there for good, be there for bad, and if you've got something, come up and say, Nick, why did you make that move or why this? Now, there's time, place to do this, but I don't think everyone's as strong as they should be.
Yeah. Who did you enjoy coaching the most? Firstly, the team, I guess, and then the individuals.
Well, I could pick moments for every club, so that'd be unfair to answer one or the other. I just clearly thoroughly enjoyed the Dogs.
Yeah.
Some of the characters there, and I still run into them from time to time. It's just outstanding, you know. My wife still meets with some of the Footscray girls. That's going back since the 80s. West Coast, I've got a great friendship with Trevor Nesbitt, and I've got if I can get to the West any time, I still meet up with Robbie Wiley, Timmy Jepp, George Young and Ian Miller. Dan Jakovich, when he comes out of Victoria, he'll inevitably give me a call and we'll have a coffee. Tommy Kemp out of the blue just rings me. Then you go to Collingwood and I've got, you can still get Benny Johnson still tell me how great he was. Paul Lucuria, Jimmy Clement, Chris Tarrant, Swanee. The list goes on. I'd be unfair to say I enjoyed coaching one club more than another. Carlton was too short to really generate that involvement.
Yep. And we're getting squeezed for time a little bit, but I know in my career there's specific moments that I've had where you just think, well, what if? Any for you?
Yeah, there's a lot of what ifs. 1996 or 7, what if Mitchell White and Andrew Donnelly didn't get Osteotis Pumas together? Because we'd won 9 or 10 in a row, really looking good.
Mm-hmm.
They did. I lost my two key forwards. Inevitably, that's it, lose that. What if Josh Fraser had played in the preliminary final in 2007? When we went to the West, we drew with West Coast, beat them in time on, beat them in out of time, went back, played Geelong, lost by 3 points. Josh pulled out on the Thursday night, and he didn't believe he could help us. I wish now I'd have talked him into playing, because he would have, even an injured ruckman, because best on ground was Oddens, he lost by 3 points, they won a one by record amount. What if? Regrets, I should have played Mitchell White in 1994. Still bugs me, I didn't. I won't say who I should have left out.
Have you had that conversation with Mitchell?
Probably have.
I'm sure he's heard you say it, but if you actually had that.
Yeah, I probably did. I wish I had. He played in 92, so it's not as if he didn't, but I wish I had played him. I wish I had got Murray Rance, his 100th. I wish I had a couple of others that pig-headedness. I probably didn't change the side when I had an opportunity to change the side with the weather, and I thought, no, I'm going to leave him out just to tell him why he's out of the side. But I, you know, one was Dougie Hawkins, and, you know, I run to Doug frequently, and he's just a beauty. I love Doug. But those regrets are the ones that make you stronger. So you'll always have regrets.
Part of the lessons learned. Yeah. Mick, we'll wrap it up with just some word associations.
Yeah.
The first thing that pops into your mind when I say St Kilda?
Feel sorry. Sorry. Yeah.
Richmond?
Love the Tigers.
Footscray?
Love the Dogs.
West Coast?
Oh, highly professional.
Collingwood?
Just amazing.
Carlton?
Bit disappointing.
Yeah. Peter Matera.
One of the best.
Glenn Djakovic.
The best.
Chris Lewis.
Extremely talented, lovely bloke.
Chris Mainwaring.
Oh, you just, it's that smile, makes you melt. What a great bloke he was.
Leon Davis.
Magic.
Scotty Burns.
Tough ass.
Paul Lucurio.
Just a beautiful person.
Eddie, you are?
Passionate.
Bucks?
Passionate.
Mark Murphy?
Probably could have been better.
Chris Judd?
Great bloke.
When was the last time you cried?
That's a damn good question. I can't remember. I know I have. Yeah. Plenty of times. And most of them have been about football.
And you have been in the game longer than most. Is there anything you'd change as the game stands?
Yes. I don't know if this is word association, but we think the game's the best in the world. Of the 9 games played every weekend, there's only 2 or 3 good games. We're going to reevaluate our assessment of where the game is, because the world game just seems to get better and better. Rugby union is, it's kept, basically kept the rules, which means that we know what you get. It's a great game. We are in constant flux because we're not satisfied. Should we be? Not too sure, but we can't constantly think we're going to get 9 good games without 9 good teams, 18 good teams having a lot of good players. We haven't got enough good players.
Mm. Mick Malthouse, the greatest, longest serving coach of our game, very much your own man. Thank you very much for the chat.
Been a pleasure, enjoyed it. We're talking footy.